This is Ron Oral, and you're listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast. And I'm super excited today to be speaking with Richard Mansouri, who recently joined the activist-focused investor and real estate company Arkhouse after spending over 25 years in investing and activism. Richard cut his chops working at Elliott Management from 1995 to 2001 as a portfolio manager. And we got to know each other when Richard joined Tom Sandel's outfit, Sandel Asset Management, another activist fund, where he worked on blockbuster campaigns like the fund's Bob Evans M&A effort, which I wrote, I don't know, maybe 6 or 7 articles at the time. It was quite fascinating. Richard has worked as a partner at Para Advisors, head of research at Della Camera Capital, and managing member at Ridge Road Asset Management. Welcome, Richard, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Ron. It's great to be here. And let me just say, I appreciate all the work you've done over the years on your podcasts discussing matters related to shareholder activism with so many interesting guests. In addition to the insight you bring when you write in the deal about situations that involve activism.
All right. Well, thank you, Richard. That was quite kind. I appreciate that. I tried over the years to get a variety of different perspectives on activism. So I'm happy to have you here. So let's get started. I think a lot of people were introduced to Arkhouse when it joined with Brigade Capital Management to make a blockbuster unsolicited $5.8 billion bid to buy department store chain Macy's. Now, Arkhouse struck a settlement to add 2 of Arkhouse candidates to the Macy's board, but no deal was ever consummated. Though I have been following the fund and Arkhouse and some other fascinating unsolicited bids and activist campaigns that they've been involved in previously. I remember I wrote about Arkhouse's bid for Columbia Property Trust, which led to a strategic review and soon after was sold for $3.9 billion, including debt, to another bidder. But I consider that to be a win for Arkhouse. I think they had a big stake. With that in mind, Richard, what kind of activism campaigns will you be working on at Arkhouse? Since, you know, I know you're an expert in all things activism, I'm wondering what sectors you might focus on. Well, is it going to be all real estate focused? Because I know that's a big part of Arkhouse's focus.
Yeah, sure. So as you mentioned, I just started at the beginning of 2025, and Arkhouse embraces a private equity philosophy when investing in public companies, which almost by definition is hands-on and actively engaged. So while Arkhouse has definitely significant experience in real estate investing, it's very likely that Arkhouse will also pursue investments in a range of other industries going forward, in addition to opportunistically looking at other real estate-oriented investments.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that sounds quite interesting. We'll be keeping an eye out for what kind of campaigns you in particular will be working on over there. So I know you're a contributor and have written 10 articles on activism governance for Forbes. And you penned this piece that I thought was quite interesting, The Poison Pillars That Impede Shareholder Activism. And, you know, poison pillars obviously is kind of a term you derive from the term poison pill or shareholders' rights plans that companies originally set up in response to hostile bids, but increasingly are installing to defend against activist hedge fund accumulations. But with your poison pillars term, you expand the term to other categories of kind of defensive tactics that companies do when facing activist investors. So you have a number of poison pillars, and one of them is, I quote, selective definition of long term. This is a poison pillar for companies. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that. I suspect it has something to do with this perception that companies think that activist investors are short-termist and not really looking out for the long-term value of the company.
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. And just a bit of background, what I tried to do as a Forbes contributor is write about some of the more frequent issues related to corporate governance that arise in the context of shareholder activism. And I try and make them a little bit more comprehensible to a wider audience. So it was in that spirit that I wrote the first 4 articles. And then the 5th article was, as you mentioned, entitled The Poison Pillars That Impede Shareholder Activism. And it served as a summary of the previous 4 articles, each of which dealt with a specific tactic or impediment, if you will, that companies often sometimes cynically use to, quote, defend themselves against an activist. So in a sense, think of an activist campaign as a metaphorical obstacle course, where an activist needs to navigate the obstacles that companies put in place, and these poison pillars serve as some of these obstacles. And now, specifically to your question about one of the poison pillars, which was actually discussed in more detail in an article entitled, quote, "The Selective Corporate Definition of Long-Term When a Shareholder Activist Shows Up," I write that quite often companies will cynically use the prefix, quote, long-term, when seeking to defend their track record, with the implicit suggestion that an activist is really, quote, short-term oriented. And very often companies are quite explicit in claiming that an activist is only interested in the short term. Okay. But what's ironic about this, and what companies often conveniently ignore, is that in many companies targeted by an activist, several members of that target company's board have already been in place for a long time. And those directors have been richly compensated along the way. And then keep in mind that activists, they often invest in companies whose stock price has underperformed over a period of years. Okay, so you'll frequently find situations where shareholders have suffered significant losses over many years, while the directors sitting on the boards of these companies personally made themselves a lot of money during that time. So you can kind of see how cynical it is to claim that an activist is only, quote, short-term oriented.
Yeah, that's fascinating because, yeah, so I guess your point is that long-term directors that have served for a very long time on boards of companies that are very bad share price performance, not such a great thing that they've been in it for focusing on the long-term. In the long-term, the company has not done that well. So maybe they need an activist investor to shift them in the right direction. Okay, another one of your poison pillars, and this one I'm constantly focusing on this topic whenever I write about activism, and it's a point that I try to instill on other reporters at the deal whenever they write about activist things. And basically, I don't allow reporters to really use the word independent director. I know that companies in their press releases and even activists, when they nominate candidates, say, you know, these are independent directors or distant incumbent directors. And I know that they meet the definition of the NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange definition of independence. But often when we dig into it, and a lot of time activists have done the work to dig into issues associated with some of these directors, they're just not that independent of management, particularly if they've been there for a long time or they have some sort of related party transaction that's not picked up by the listing center. So, Richard, another one of your poison pillars is, quote, reliance on questionable independent directors. So tell us a little about that and tell us about the problems that we should have with the term independent director.
Yeah, I address this poison pillar in more detail in an article. It was entitled, How Independent Are the Independent Directors of Public Companies? And I note that good corporate governance demands that a board be comprised of a majority, and really a large majority of, quote, independent directors. Okay, the theory being that independent directors won't be subject to undue influence or conflicts of interest, and they'll therefore be able to make impartial decisions free from bias. The problem is that many public companies, and probably the vast majority, utilize some very, very broad and forgiving standards in determining whether a director is independent, such as the general definition of independent, which is set forth by, you know, exchanges like New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. Unfortunately, this definition of independent is really inadequate and doesn't contemplate the many potential situations where a director technically qualifies as independent based on those standards, but may still be subject to significant inherent bias. And in this article, I cite a few directors who technically qualified as independent, but here to give you one example. Okay, so there was a situation where there was someone who was president of a university and he sat on the board of a public company, and the university at which he was president received $1 million personal donation from that public company's CEO. So query how impartial.
Yeah, not very independent there.
No. One has to ask, how impartial could that particular director really be in that specific situation?
No, absolutely. There's definitely questions about independent directors. I wrote an article today about a company that removed the director after an activist pointed out a kind of relationship that director had that would not make him very independent to oversee the board. And I see this all the time. I mean, typically the activists are very good at identifying these relationships that are not picked up on even by the proxy advisor. I mean, the proxy advisors then sometimes point to the activist's research even in their recommendation reports. But previous years have, you know, not even picked up these relationships that the activists find. So definitely, I'm very careful. I do not like to use the word independent director, even if they meet the NASDAQ New York Stock Exchange listing requirements. I have to do kind of a more in-depth research into those candidates, particularly in the situation.
Yeah, sometimes it's not easy at all to actually, you know, look behind the scenes and actually trace the true degree of independence or not. Yeah, sometimes it's very opaque to unearth that information. So I understand what you're saying.
Okay, so there's another category, and this is one that corporate offices will never admit, that when they add directors, when an activist is agitating, they're essentially doing it as a, with quote unquote, defensive refresh. So this is a term that the people in the advisory world, whether they're advising companies or advising activists in proxy fights, they use quietly behind the scenes. Companies would never admit they're doing a defensive refresh of director candidates, but that's in fact what they often are doing. And so what you often see is activists launches a director contest. The company brings in a couple new directors to replace some directors that have red flags, you know, be it they're over tenured, overboarded, have these relationships that we just talked about that the activist identified, bring their own director candidates. And this kind of hurts the activist's ability to get its dissident candidates to get on the board. So tell us about that. I mean, do you agree with my thesis that companies bring in their own directors to replace the red flag directors? It can hurt the activist's ability to get their own candidates elected. And I'm wondering if activists will time their campaign launches perhaps to avoid giving the companies enough time to replace their problematic directors on their own.
You know, you raise a very important issue, and your terminology, the defensive refresh, that's very apt terminology. And, you know, actually, I discussed this more expansively in the article I wrote. It was called Some Companies Appoint New Directors in Order to Thwart Shareholder Activists. And this is indeed one of the four poison pillars. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that what happens all too often is that a company's board, when learning that an activist has bought stock in the company, that company's board unilaterally and reflexively adds a number of new directors to the board. And this is troubling for a variety of reasons. The most obvious being that this illustrates a pattern that many underperforming companies demonstrate, in that their board is being reactive to a situation mm-hmm. and had probably been oblivious to some other underlying problems which attracted the activists in the first place, rather than proactively seeking to address those problems a long time ago. And I'll say there's something else. There's another, call it cynical and maybe less obvious rationale behind such defensive maneuvers, because a key yardstick used in the governance space to reflect the overall soundness of a board is the average length of tenure of members on the board. The thinking being that a board comprised of too many long-tenured directors can be unresponsive to new ideas. So by appointing new directors in this defensive refresh, mm-hmm. a company can significantly change the average length of board tenure and cosmetically give the appearance that they're embracing good governance. Now, specifically, you ask about activist timing and the ability to wage a campaign. And it's a good question. It's a difficult question, because if an activist nominates directors too early, a company could have an advantage and replace some existing directors with those who, you know, ostensibly might compare more favorably with the activist nominees. But if an activist waits too long, a company may have already resorted to this tactic and added a number of new directors. So it's a very relevant aspect of the activist defense playbook that one has to be aware of.
Yeah, no, this is fascinating, because I often see these press releases, and then the PR people call me up and they're saying, oh, these new directors that we brought on after XYZ activists launched their campaign or their director contest, these new incumbent management backed directors that we brought on, they were part of an extensive process where we hired a director search firm or executive search firm. And we'd been looking for candidates long before the activists showed up. And these new directors have nothing to do with the activist campaign. You know, basically just a coincidence that they were brought on in some cases weeks or days before the proxy contest concluded. There was a situation I wrote just the other day where they removed a targeted director, brought in a new director on the Friday, like basically like a few days before the contest took place, which is extremely last minute. And it helped the company ultimately win that contest, in my view. So I guess just kind of a follow-up question, Richard. So maybe it's true that they had this director search process in place where they had these candidates. But my feeling is, you know, maybe they'd be mulling them over, and the incumbent board is very entrenched. They don't want to lose their well-paying jobs. And I could see a situation where the company had actually looked at some director candidates, but it wasn't until the activists showed up that they really moved into high gear. They're like, okay, these candidates that we've been kind of floating around for the last year, we got to bring them in now because otherwise we're going to lose this proxy fight. Is that a scenario that you could see happening? And, you know, then the company has some cover saying, oh, you know, we did actually consider these before, but really expedited it.
Right. Well, again, that gets to what I was saying beforehand. I mean, this is in that specific, I don't know specifically the example you're talking about, but just in general, that's just an illustration of a board being reactive to a situation, right? They've been oblivious to something. It's only after the activist shows up that they start taking affirmative steps, whereas a good functioning board would have addressed issues a long time ago. And another thing which one has to just ask from a macro perspective is one has to consider that the directors that have been chosen to be added to the board, the directors currently on the board are choosing these new directors. So it begs the question, if the current board had been unaware of these existing problems, why should people really have a lot of confidence that they're going to pick the right new directors? I guess that's another fundamental question someone needs to ask.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I will continue to very carefully watch these defensive refreshes and call them for what they really are, defensive refreshes. But okay. I wanted to talk about, I guess, another one of your poison pillars. Like this maybe is your final one, weaponization of company money. And I suspect this has to do with, you know, the activist wants to make some changes, improve the share price value, and the company will hire all sorts of advisors, spend so much of the company money, the shareholder money, in kind of pushing back on the activist agenda. And actually, I feel like I saw this recently in a contest I just watched where a sub-billion market cap company had hired two proxy solicitors, two PR / crisis communication firms, high-powered defense firm. And I don't know, it just seemed kind of a little bit of overkill. I could see that a large cap company, I've seen them hire two proxy solicitors, but a small one like this. Anyways, that's a long way of saying, tell us what you mean, Richard, by weaponization of company money.
Yeah, well, I think you were kind of hitting the nail right on the head. Okay, the article that discusses this poison pillar more broadly was entitled Using the Money of the Owners, the Shareholders Against the Owners, Fellow Shareholders, and deals with this issue of the weaponization of corporate cash against activists. This was actually the first article. My first article as a contributor, and it introduced a fundamental principle of capitalism that should be obvious, but it goes unrecognized or unremarked far too often, which is the owners of a company are its shareholders. So when a company seeks to defend itself against an activist, the company can start to incur significant expenses, like you were alluding to, seeking to find ways to thwart the activist. And these expenses are paid for by the company. So the company is using its money to defend itself. And since the owners of the company are the shareholders, the company is basically using the shareholder's money against a fellow shareholder, as the activist is obviously a shareholder as well. So if you look at it that way, you can start to see the problem, right? Is every dollar spent by a company on activist defense essentially comes out of the pocket of the shareholders. And these expenses can certainly add up. And in theory, a company can spend a nearly unlimited amount of its existing cash to, quote, defend themselves against one of its very own shareholders.
Yeah. And sometimes in the settlement, they have to pay the activist fees. You know, that's an additional payment. And so I just finished an article where I had pointed out a lot of times those settlements happen before the contests go definitive, because once you file a definitive proxy statement, then the costs really start to escalate with, you know, the proxy solicitors, you're doing the fight decks, the companies are spending lots of money preparing for their ISS Glass Lewis meetings. And those costs really accelerate on both sides, but in particular for the companies, you know, spending the shareholder money. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting point you bring up, Richard, that it's that you're weaponizing the shareholder money by defending the company against an activist campaign. So
indeed.
All right. You've been listening to the Activist Investing Today podcast with Ron Orrell. And we've been talking to Richard Mansouri of ArcHouse. Richard, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much, Ron. Good to be here.